Hello, and welcome to episode 12 of That Yoga Woman's podcast, a podcast where yogis, yoga teachers, and studio owners share stories of their lives on and off the mat. I'm Jules Buchanan, a yoga teacher and your host. This week, I'm talking to Jamie Tyler. Yes, I'm welcoming our first male yoga teacher to the podcast. Jamie teaches different styles of yoga, hot, hatha, vinyasa, rockies, and wheel, to name a few, at a number of yoga studios across Bedfordshire and Buckinghamshire, and he lives in a village with his wife and his little girl and his baby boy. He's relatively newly qualified as a yoga teacher, 2 years I think, but he had his first taste of yoga 20 years ago when he started to attend yoga classes in London. He was drawn to yoga as a way to stay strong and flexible whilst working as a performer in West End musicals. Yes, Jamie's appeared in multiple theatre productions, including most recently working with the Royal Shakespeare Company. Woo! So, as with my other guests, we'll delve into his non-yoga life too and find out what the theatre industry is really like. Jamie also took an interesting, read non-traditional, route into theatre roles, gaining experience working on cruise ships rather than going to drama school. So we'll also hear how that side of his career got started. Married to a successful musician, Jamie, when their daughter was born, was initially a stay-at-home dad, which is when his love of yoga really started to blossom, as he found he became a much more patient parent. We'll discuss his perceptions around the impact of yoga on his parenting. So much to talk about. I'm keen to get to know Jamie a bit better, and I really hope you enjoy our conversation. So thank you, Jamie, and welcome to That Yoga Woman's podcast.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So I must say, our first man on the podcast.
I mean,
it hasn't been intentional to have had only women on the podcast so far, but that's just basically how it's been. It might just be me. Outside of London, have you come across many male yoga teachers?
Do you know what? There don't seem to be as many, actually. There's a couple working in the area, but I'm not sure if there's that many doing it as a career. I think maybe I'm a lot more available than most male yoga teachers in the area, because I'm kind of doing it full time, whereas I think a lot of the other ones have full time jobs, and so they're only doing the odd couple of classes. But yeah, it's mostly women, definitely.
And this is probably a bit of an unfair, well, it is an unfair question. It's not probably, it definitely is, but I'll ask it anyway. Do you think there have been any ways so far in which your experiences teaching yoga have differed from what you think those of a woman would have been?
Oh, well, I think it's helped me in a lot of ways. I think it's helped me get jobs, because it looks great for the studios to have men and women, you know, on their timetable, because some clients really respond well to certain type of teachers. So I think that's helped, and it's helped kind of just grab people's interest, because when I trained, it was about 12 or 13 of us, and I was the only bloke. So I suppose you kind of stand out a bit, which is helpful. But I don't think in the ways that I teach it's any different to how anyone else would teach. I think we all kind of teach similar things, but maybe it's sometimes comforting for when blokes come to a class and they see a man at the front. I think sometimes there's that kind of slight comfort of thinking, oh yeah, this isn't a girly thing, because there's a bloke doing it. So obviously, you know, it's fine. If their girlfriend's like dragged them along to a class, or their wife, then it does provide some kind of comfort, going, oh no, it's okay. It's a manly thing.
Yeah, it is a manly thing. So, and then pre-COVID, you'd carved out teaching slots at, like, I think it was 4 different local studios. So how are you finding that combination of working for different studios? Like, roughly how many classes were you teaching a week, and what does that compare to now?
It works out about 12 or 13 classes a week. And amazingly, this time, actually, it's just carried on. Like, all the studios have been really prepared for it. I think this time round, the first lockdown, it was suddenly there was no yoga and there was nothing to do, and was just looking after the kids and everything. And then it crept back in and there was the odd online classes. Whereas this time, I think everyone's so set up for it that I'm keeping exactly the same schedule I did, but just doing it to empty rooms and just a kind of device in the corner, which feels really odd. But my schedule hasn't had to change at all so far, touch wood. I mean, we're only in week 2, so it might change.
So we're just in the middle of the second lockdown, aren't we? So is that a good balance for you? Do you find that's enough?
Yeah, it works out about right, actually, because even on really busy days, there's some days where I'm teaching three classes a day, but it's quite nice because they're either in the morning or in the evening. So I get to spend the bulk of the day. I still get to do a lot of the time. I get to do the school pickup and get to actually sit down and have dinner with the family. And then I'll kind of head off just as my wife's doing bath time and kind of sorting them out and getting them to bed. So it feels like I'm not, it's not taking me away from family life too much, which is lovely. And I'm still getting out of the house and doing stuff and seeing people and enjoying myself. So it's worked out quite well, actually. Like, I'm enjoying it.
Sounds like it. Good.
Yeah, I'm very lucky.
Good. So you were an actor, dancer and singer before you even thought about teaching yoga. How did you get into dancing? I presume that came along before the acting and the singing. Well, I mean, I might be wrong, but what sort of age were you when you started?
I was about four, and I think I was really into the Kids from Fame. Do you remember that in the 80s?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and I remember telling my mum that I wanted to be an actor and a dancer and stuff. So she got me involved in some youth things that my cousin was into. And my first performance, I was 4 or 5 years old as the genie of the lamp in Aladdin. And I was painted head to toe in green paint, had these little speedos on, would kind of jump in from the wings and shout poof. And yeah. And I think everyone laughed and thought I was cute because I was really small. And so from that point on, I was like, yes, I want to be an actor. And yeah. And so from that point on, I was in every youth thing or Amdram thing kind of for, yeah, as long as I can remember. And the whole family was involved as well. Yeah.
Oh, really? Yeah. It's a family thing.
Yeah. My brother's an opera singer. My dad became involved in the Amateur Dramatic Society through taking us to rehearsals, and my cousin and my auntie, and you know, my mum would run the social committee and all that stuff. So it was a big old family affair.
Oh, that's nice. And your brother, he's like an actual opera singer now. And it's like, I don't know why I said like an actual one. He's not a hobby, just a hobby on the side.
Yeah. he's kind of similar to me at the moment. He's starting to do a different career. He's starting to work in psychotherapy and all this kind of stuff. So he lives with his boyfriend in Geneva, but he's training in Glasgow. And so he's doing all kinds of exciting things other than opera at the moment. But he's been an opera singer for the last however many years.
Wow. So after school, most actors I would expect would have attended some sort of drama school, but you didn't take that route. So tell us about what you did.
Yeah, I was desperate to go to drama school. I really wanted to. And that was everything that I'd worked up to. And I got my place at Mountview, which was in London, and, you know, was really excited about it, and then just couldn't get the funding. And my council wouldn't fund me. And I remember sat in the sixth form common room writing letters to everybody, you know, just begging for money. And just couldn't get the money together. And so I decided I'd take a year of just auditioning for things. And then hopefully, because I'd been auditioning so much, it would give me a little bit more experience the following year to maybe get sponsorship, or, you know, kind of somebody would take pity and give me some money to go to this drama school. And then in that year, I got a job working on a cruise ship, and that kind of started everything off, really.
So that's something I would like to think, a cruise ship, that just sounds a fab job to me. But I bet, like, seeing the world, traveling, quite glamorous, but I bet the reality is so different. I'm kidding myself. I bet the reality is totally different. And I bet it's so tough. I bet it's nonstop work. Just what was it like?
Oh, do you know what? The first one, it was bonkers. Like, the fact they took me on when I hadn't trained and everything else kind of shows that it might have been a slightly substandard ship. Because it was, I think I was on about £130 a week.
And wow.
We did two shows a night. I was sharing a cabin with the ship magician, but the cabin was so tiny, it was absolutely minuscule. You'd have to, if you wanted to both get ready to go out, one of you would have to get dressed and then lie in your bed fully clothed while the other one got out and got dressed, because there wasn't room for two people to stand up. And it was just cockroach infested. And yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I had a ball, because it was all around Singapore and Malaysia and Thailand, and I was 18, I think, so I had the absolute time of my life. But it was a dodgy ship.
I mean, did you get off to see places?
Yeah, we did. We'd get off in the day. That we had duties every other day. So your duties would be kind of like taking a ballroom class or running shuffleboard up on deck 11 or running the
those animation room. People that drive around at the wall, totally. Like, come along, join in with this.
That was it. Yeah, that was exactly it. But then every other day you'd get off, and there was always Wednesday when we're on Patong Beach in Thailand, and that was always like a big day off. And yeah, so we did get to see a lot of it. We got to spend a lot of time in Singapore as well, because that's where the boat was docked. But it sank a couple of weeks after I got off it.
It sank?
It was
such a dodgy. Was everyone all right?
Yeah, they all survived remarkably. And someone told me, like, an engineer came on board and he was coming down to assess the engines. And I chatted to him before he went down there, and then saw him the next, later that day. And I remember he sat there with a whiskey, and I said, "You're right, mate." And he kind of looked at me and said, "You need to get off this ship because it's going down like within the next couple of months." And I didn't believe him. Finished my time there, and then left. And then a couple of weeks later, it was on headline news.
Oh my God. That's so scary. I can't believe he probably least said about that the better. He must have been feeling a bit bad, nursing a whiskey. Blimey.
He headed straight off the next day, and it was, so I don't know. It was a fire in the engine room that sent it down in the end.
Lucky that no lives were lost then.
No, exactly. Yeah. I saw my friends on the news kind of in the lifeboat waving up at the helicopter cameras.
Goodness me. That sounds horrendous. Hello. Yeah. They're like, not and really. Not okay.
The headline was cruise ship sinks in shark infested waters. I remember that.
Yeah, you don't even think it's bad enough they're sinking. You don't even think about having to deal with whatever else is there. Blimey.
Well
out of that then. Did you get another ship then after that?
Yeah. Do you know what I did? Years later, I did a P&O ship as a singer, and that was a completely different thing. It was wonderful. It was like my own cabin. We did about two or three shows a week, and the rest of the time you were just considered a passenger. And so it was a 40-day voyage from Southampton to Singapore, stopping off everywhere on the way. And then it went back a different route, and then it did the Caribbean and the Amazon, and it was fabulous. It was just like kind of paid holiday, really.
Yeah, that sounds like more of what I had in mind.
Yeah.
But you, from a practical perspective then, you got that a bit later when you'd got plenty more experience under your belt then.
Yeah. And I kind of felt it was at a point in my life where I'd been touring a lot and touring the UK. And I thought, I really fancy traveling again. And I really wanted to sing more as well. So I thought, if I get a job singing on a cruise ship, it'll be the perfect experience. And it just got me away for a bit.
Yeah. So what was your first job in like theatre proper on land, so to speak?
Oh, it was a little show called Honk. And it was the story of the Ugly Duckling. And it's a really good, it did really well at the National and stuff later on, but this version of it was the first time it was shown in London, and it was in a pub theatre. So it was profit share, which meant I earned kind of no money from it whatsoever. But
sounds good though, doesn't it? Profit share. You're like, oh, that sounds inclusive.
Yeah. I got a check about 6 months afterwards for my share of the profits, and I think it was
£17.98. No, you're joking.
Honestly. No, honestly, because it was, they'd hired a band and they'd got a really good set, and there was a load of tube strikes during the time. So their audience was less on a couple of nights than they thought it was going to be. And so that's all the money that they were able to share out between us, us performers. But it got me an agent. So it was kind of worth it.
Oh, did it?
That. Yeah.
So is that how it works then? You go and you're in things and then you get spotted, kind of.
Yeah. It's.
Was that how it worked for you anyway?
Yeah, I think it's trickier now because I think there's more people and it's a harsher business. I think it's more difficult to get spotted. So I think now there's a lot more emphasis on having to train because the agents come and watch the showcases at the drama schools. And then they'll take you on from that. Whereas I think maybe back when I started, agents would be a little more willing to kind of come and watch you and things or take you on even though you hadn't had much experience. Whereas I think it's so competitive now. There's so many people.
So did you face these challenges when you like trying to get auditions because you didn't have any like formal training?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I got it a lot. I got a lot of, you know, you'd come into a room and sing, and then they'd say, "Oh, that's lovely." And where did you train? And I'd say, "Oh, I didn't." And I'd literally kind of see their faces drop. And
yeah, then, yeah. So like University of Life, it was one of those.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
I wonder why it makes such a difference then. I wonder why.
Yeah,
it, like, if you're good enough and they liked what they saw, I wonder why it would make a difference, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. I wonder if they're worried about how you'll be in the company or just having the experience to, you know, deal with all that, deal with 8 shows a week. And I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. I guess because people don't look and be like, oh, hang on, where did they train? I better check before I come and see the show. I don't want to.
No, exactly. Yeah.
I don't want to see someone who hasn't been to a drama school.
Yeah, it's true. As soon as you get that first kind of big job, then that's what they look at rather than the training. They kind of say, oh, you've done that show, so you're all right for this. Yeah.
I suppose it's the same as in any other career, isn't it? Like when you have your first CV or your first, it's got like little things on that as you get a bet, like your next job, you think, oh, no one needs to know about when I was a bar, when I worked in the local pub one summer. I can take that off my CV now.
Yeah, it's true.
Oh, so and how do you tackle auditions? Do you get nervous?
Oh, do you know what I do? Yeah. Yeah, I still do. Yoga's helped, actually.
Really?
Yeah, since kind of being a yogi, and especially breath work, because breath work is so linked in with singing as well. Doing a bit of pranayama before going into an audition helps massively. And just for confidence as well. Just, yeah, I find it now with everything. If I do a bit of yoga before it, you know, if I'm in a show and I'm suddenly flung on to kind of the part that I'm covering is ill or something, and I suddenly have to go on for their part, usually get really nervous. Now I take myself off 20 minutes of yoga and I'm kind of feel confident again and, you know, just feel a bit calmer. So I wish I'd have had it all through my career, because I'm sure I've done some shocking auditions where I've been a bit nervous and things have gone awry.
Yeah, but nervous energy is a good thing probably, isn't it? To give you a bit of adrenaline.
Yeah, it is, but it can affect you singing-wise, because a lot of auditions, you sing first.
Right.
I think the voice is so vulnerable anyway, you can have such an effect if you're nervous or anxious, you know, on your singing voice.
Yeah, a bit of the old shaky-shaky, I bet it happens.
Oh, totally, yeah. And that fear when you know the big note is coming up and you think, oh, I'm going to get it. Yeah,
and have you ever been starstruck?
Yeah, do you know what? I'm kind of a bit rubbish with celebrities. Like, I've worked with a lot of celebrities and I find that I'm so worried about looking sycophantic and being that person that's coming up to them trying to be their best mate because they're a celebrity, that I feel like I almost look the opposite way. Like, I probably look a bit rude.
Yeah, a bit more aloof. You're like, yeah, whatever. I'm not bothered.
Exactly. Yeah. And I find it really difficult because I don't want to be that person that sidles up to them when they're, you know, getting their coffee at lunchtime and try and be their best mate. But they probably need that because they're just a person starting out in a cast as well.
Yeah, I think unless you're in that position, you wouldn't know how you reacted. It's one of those. I don't think unless you're confronted by the person, I don't think you'd know how you would respond, whether you'd just be like, yeah, too cool for school, or whether you'd be like, take a selfie with me, take a selfie with me.
Absolutely. I think I'd be a bit starstruck. I'm a Coronation Street fan. So if I was like working with someone from Corrie, I'd find that probably I'd be a bit more starstruck than that than I would if it was a Hollywood A-lister, I think.
Yeah.
Because they're so familiar.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I years and years ago we went to see a play in London, and we were outside, and Mr. Big from Sex and the City was outside. Oh, and he had like, it was obviously it wasn't Mr. Big because it was just the actor Chris Noth, but in my mind it was like, oh, it's Big. And I said to James, I was like, it's big. He was like, oh my god, it is Big, because he loves Sex and the City too. And then he was just looking like around, and we were like, oh, he's waiting for Carrie. So we just like, we went in and just left him out there, and we were like, oh, that was just perfect, because if someone else would have come, it would have been like, who are you? That's not Carrie, get off.
Yeah. You kept the illusion.
Yeah, we kept the illusion, so that was all. But yeah, I wouldn't have gone and said anything, obviously. I just made a complete idiot of myself. But oh no, okay. So can you give us some of your career highlights to date? I know that you appeared in the RSC's production of Boy in a Dress last year, right? Like, wasn't so for the people that don't know, I had to have a little look. I wasn't sure, but it's the David Walliams novel that was then made into a musical, which featured music from Robbie Williams and his writing partner Guy Chambers. Yes.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was brilliant. It was a really fun show, and we've just released the album. That's coming out on December the 5th, which is exciting.
That is exciting. And you feature on that, do you?
Yeah, I mean, solo wise, I think you hear like one solo line of mine, but I'm in the ensemble.
That's all that matters. Your name's on it.
Yeah, that was quite a highlight, and it was lovely. I mean, working at the RSC is brilliant. Like, that's kind of a career highlight, just getting to work there. Cause I did, I've done three seasons with them. I've done, Love's Labour's Lost and Much Ado About Nothing, which was in the West End, and then Twelfth Night and Christmas Carol, and then Boy in the Dress. And so working for them has been like a massive highlight, cause they're just an incredible company and obviously such amazing history and such amazing people have been there that I've kind of felt a bit in awe.
I bet. I mean, I'm probably being a bit thick here, but Royal Shakespeare Company, when I saw the Boy in the Dress, I was like, hang on, that's not Shakespeare. What's going on?
Yeah, no, they do, because they're a production house as well. Like, they started Matilda, for example. Like, that was a Royal Shakespeare production. And Les Mis was originally a Royal Shakespeare Company production. So they do musicals every so often. But yeah, mostly Shakespeare.
Right. Okay. When I saw that, I was like, oh, I don't get that. Oh, so you've done Shakespeare with them as well. How did you get on with the language and the technical side? You love it.
Yeah. You know, I loved it. And that was scary because, so basically I'd not really had much experience in Shakespeare before, like at all professionally. And I loved it just from kind of.
How did you get that gig then? Come on. How did you get in there? I'd love to have seen that audition. Was it a Blag Central? Like, oh, yeah, I love Shakespeare.
No, it was a weird thing because I was working, I did Spamalot, like the Monty Python musical, and I was playing Sir Lancelot and covering King Arthur, who was played by Joe Pasquale at the time. And so working with the director on that, the director also worked on a lot of Shakespeare productions. And so kind of got to work with him a lot, and Joe was ill for a week. So I got on as King Arthur. And so the director kind of came and saw me in that. And he said to me, oh, have you ever considered doing Shakespeare? And I kind of just laughed and was like, you know, I didn't even train, I'm never going to get considered to do Shakespeare. And then, I took a year out, to work in a school when Daisy was born, my daughter, so that I could spend more time being a dad. And then suddenly got a phone call kind of at the end of that year just saying, do you want to do these two Shakespeare plays? And so I didn't have to audition. And yeah, just suddenly got, and it was two, there were two plays running together in the West End, Love's Labour's Lost and Much Ado About Nothing. And so, yeah. And I arrived on that first day of rehearsal, literally shaking because I was sat around the table with all these like amazing kind of actors that were so used to doing all the Shakespeare stuff and had worked at the RSC for years. And there was kind of me sat there.
So presumably you'd read them through before you went.
Yeah. And I knew I'd kind of studied them a lot, and I'd spent ages just on YouTube and doing any kind of anything I could find that was related to Shakespeare that would just help me learn a little bit more. Mm. And it was only like, I was playing tiny, tiny parts, but I was understudying the bigger roles. So it was quite nice because I got a chance to work with the assistant director, and he kind of coached me through everything, and they're just lovely. Like, yeah, you have all these voice calls and everything, and it's just so well set up. You get so long to rehearse, and they take so much care in you as an actor that you really get to kind of learn it properly.
So more of those on the way, fingers crossed for you. Is that in the plan?
I don't know. Well, I don't know what the plan is at the moment, to be honest. I've kind of thrown the plan out the window now.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. We'll come on to that. We'll come on to that a bit later. So, I wanted to ask you a question about the doing Shakespeare. And, so you said it was in the West End. How do they decide what's in Stratford and what's in the West End?
Well, they usually start off in Stratford, and then they'll sometimes transfer to the West End. So this was a production that had started about a year before that, and it had run in Stratford and kind of got very good reviews. And so then they decided to put the production on in the West End. Hmm. And so I was just replacing somebody that had left.
And what is that on at the Globe or not?
No, it was on at the Haymarket.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was just a limited run. So it was just, I think it was about 3 or 4 months over Christmas.
So from what you said, I know you said you worked with a director, and then it sort of seems that the more people you work with and the relationships you build, the easier it is to get into things. Is it quite a bit of who you know rather than what you know?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I think it kind of has to be in a way. I think people don't want to put their neck on the line and take on somebody completely new for a production. I think because you have to work so closely together and it's all so collaborative, and there's such a risk that if you get the wrong person for a job, it can really upset the cast or it can really upset the balance. And so people do tend to hire people that they've worked with before or that they know people that have worked with. I think there's a lot of,
it's like trust, isn't it? It's hard. It must be hard to break in, but you've proved that it can be done. But then it's element of trust. You've got to build trust with people, and that's how the relationships work. That's what it sounds like. Would you say that was how it is?
Absolutely, yeah. If you look through somebody's CV, when you get the program of a West End show or something, you can literally trace job by job. When you look through it and you know, you're like, all right, those five jobs are with the same casting director. So they've obviously kind of, that person likes them. And then that job had the same artistic director as that one. So that's probably how they got that. And you can see that, yeah, it all links.
Gosh, I suppose once you're in, like you're in now, unless there's like massive changes at the top, then you're kind of in. It must be like devastating if you don't ever get in. You've just got to try, I suppose. Yeah. Keep trying, haven't you?
Yeah. And it's always such a gamble. I mean, even when you're in, you still don't know where the next job is going to come from or if you're ever going to get cast again. As soon as you finish a job, you kind of feel like you're back at the beginning, and suddenly it's, you know, just waiting for the auditions to come in. And
so you don't get to the point where you're lining up work for when you've finished one. You don't think, oh, I'm going to be, it doesn't get to that.
Not really. No. I mean, for some people it might, but often you know what your next job is going to be afterwards, but that's only if you've had the time to go and audition for them whilst you're doing your show in the evening. And so sometimes it lines up. But it's very difficult. It's difficult to kind of have any continuity with it. You get
that sounds really stressful.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Financially, that would sound really stressful.
And it's also vulnerable as well. And I've found, especially as soon as we had a child, it really brought home just how vulnerable it was. So I was on a job like just before we had Daisy, and we were supposed to be going and doing this big American tour. And it was the arena tour of Jesus Christ Superstar. And, you know, there were celebrities involved and everything. And it was like massive news. And we finished a rehearsal on the Friday night. We're supposed to be flying out to New Orleans on the Monday, and got an email on the way home saying the tour had been cancelled because some kind of financial thing. And that was the next, you know, 6 months worth of work and 6 months worth of money and everything that my wife and I had kind of planned for that just suddenly was just dead. And so, yeah, it is really vulnerable place to be, I think, working in the business.
So I guess with COVID coming, a lot of people have had to deal with what you've had to deal with previously. Do you feel a bit hardened to it because of what you've had to experience in the past? I suppose it's still devastating, isn't it?
Yeah, I just feel for them, especially young people in the industry at the moment, because there's just nothing for them. And it's so sad. Like my wife is, she's associate musical director on The Lion King. So she obviously can't do a job at the moment until the show comes back. And, you know, that whole cast, they're all out of work and everyone involved in it. And it's just all of our friends who are musicians or actors or wiggies or, you know, the kind of wardrobe people, the stage doorkeepers, they're all just out of work and have got no options really. And, you know, they're kind of being told to retrain and things like this. But
yeah, like that dodgy advert that was put out with the ballerina on it. That wasn't great, was it?
Crazy, because you have to devote your whole life to it, really. I mean, it takes up so much of your life to get to the point where you can actually do the job, that you know, you don't really have anything else to fall back on a lot of the time. You know, it's not like you can just go and get an equally kind of an equal level job. It's not, you know, it doesn't work, really work like that.
So is that one of the reasons that you wanted to do yoga teacher training then?
Yeah, I kind of...
Not that that pays amazingly well.
Yeah, it was an interesting one because, well, with theatre, I've had this feeling pretty much since having kids that for me, it's a struggle to find kind of the holy grail. Like I don't know what I'm aiming for with theatre sometimes, because you do show after show. And so you go through a whole big audition process and you really work hard, and then you get a show and you realize it's kind of the same pay and the same lifestyle as the one you had previously. But when it finishes, you're back to square one again. And it felt a bit like, I don't really know what I'm aiming for, because I don't think there's a point that I'll get to where I'll suddenly get to spend lots of time with the family and have enough money and I'll have that work-life balance. Cause I don't know if that exists. It might do. And there might be people that have really cracked it. But I think even if you're incredibly successful and get, you know, part in a soap or something like that, it's still taking up a load of your time and you're away from your family and there's still this kind of weird imbalance. So yeah, I was having a bit of a think about it over the last however many years and just trying to work out what it was that I actually wanted. And it was, I've always wanted to spend more time with my family and still do something that I love. And yeah, yoga has become such a passion that I didn't think I'd ever find anything that I loved as much as theatre or that I'd want to do as much as theatre. So it's just the most amazing thing that I've kind of got this thing now that I'm as passionate about and just couldn't do without.
I mean, you mentioned before like touring productions, so that must have been really tough with your home life. Like, how did you, you said it takes up so much of your life, but if you're on, that's one thing if you've got a commute to work, but at least you're coming back home to the same bed. But if you're touring around, like, that must be really difficult as well.
Yeah, I haven't toured since having children, because
okay.
Yeah, so as soon as that happened, I told my agent, you know, you can put me up for auditions for this and this, but there's no way I can tour now. And
was that a discussion? Is that something you were like, yeah, that's not happening, or was that a discussion with your wife where you because you were a stay-at-home dad, weren't you, when your daughter was born? Was that an easy conversation to have with your wife? Or
yeah, we kind of took it in turn. So when Daisy was born, I was working in a school, and then I got the Shakespeare job. So I did that, and my wife was kind of stay-at-home mum. And then we swapped over again because my wife started doing another production in the West End, but they let her do a bit of a job share, so it wasn't too heavy. So we literally spent a couple of years of just taking it in turns to do jobs. So we'd sit down month by month and be like, right.
Parenting plan. Well, that sounds like true co-parenting then. It wasn't, because I read that you were a stay-at-home dad. I assumed that it was like a conversation that you'd had, and it was like, right, I will stay at home and not work, and now you will go out and earn the money in the West End. And so, but it doesn't sound like that at all. It sounds like it was proper co-parenting, how I would envisage it, where, like you say, you're planning month to month and like, well, how is it, I'm planning to work on this, you're planning to work on that, what can we do and how do we manage as a family? That sounds the best way of doing it. So you don't feel like you're losing out, neither of you?
No, it worked quite well. Like, because, yeah, my wife, at that point, she got a big job doing Company in the West End, was kind of this big show that was happening. And so when she got that, I was happy to say, well, do you know what? I'll stay at home then with Daisy, because I've just finished a job and I'm knackered and I really want to spend some time with Daisy. And so, you know, it kind of just seemed to work out.
Yeah, that's it. I think it's all about timing. It sounds like, with stuff like that, it sounds like you've just got to get the timing right. It must be quite tricky. You wouldn't want to stop your partner from having an amazing opportunity, but at the same time, you've got responsibilities to share. So,
yeah, exactly. And I suppose there's also the financial thing as well, that she gets paid a lot more than I do if she works, because of her position as a musical director, whereas my position as an actor. So a lot of times when we look at it, it kind of makes more sense for her to do the job and me look after the kids and that kind of stuff. But it's kind of working out at the moment, because on The Lion King, she's not doing eight shows a week. It's kind of comes in, takes rehearsals, and she conducts the show a couple of times a week, but it's not as full on as when you're on the show kind of every day. So it kind of makes more sense for her to work.
And do you think there is an element of flexibility being introduced in the theatre industry for families, for people with family time, or are people still quite harsh? Do you think they don't care?
I think there's a real conscious effort. There's a committee that's been set up called PIPA, P-I-P-A, and that's Parents in Performing Arts. And so there is kind of a representative and a body of people that are looking at every contract and trying to make it easier for parents to work and trying to accommodate things like job shares and things like that. But I think there's a long way to go. It's still incredibly difficult. There's still moments, you know, where I was working and I knew that I could pick Daisy up at 8 o'clock, which meant if I left rehearsals at 6, I could get there for 8. And then the day before, you'd be told, oh, actually, we're rehearsing till 9 o'clock today. And you're just absolutely kind of in a corridor somewhere on the phone begging people to pick up your child because, you know, there's no other way to do it. And it's just really stressful. So I think there is a way to go.
Yeah, I can imagine that must be stressful. I guess all actors have that, don't they? If they're balancing family and maybe another career, if they're trying to do other work alongside, you know, to fill in those gaps and to plug the holes between so that you've got a constant income, like almost a constant income, that must be hard to then just drop whatever that other career is. It must be super flexible. If you found that when you're with the studios that you work with, have they been, because obviously if you want to get into another show when things can and when things open up again, you want to get into another show. Have they been quite positive about you just being like, yeah, see ya, I need to crack on down in London now?
Well, do you know what? It happens with them because when I finished my training, I was intending to just work as a yoga teacher. And then we realized that we're having Milo, our second child, and that my wife would be taking maternity leave, and she was too new to the show actually to get kind of full maternity cover and stuff. And so we suddenly realized that I'd have to work. And so that was how Boy in the Dress came around, because that audition came up and we're like, oh, that bridges that gap over the maternity leave, and it would mean that we got a decent wage coming in. And so I had to explain to studios after sending them letters saying, can I be on your cover list or can I do a few classes? And then coming back and being so lovely and saying, yeah, we'll take you on for this class or whatever. I then had to explain to them, actually, I'm going to be away, going away to do this show. And they were all really lovely, actually. They all kind of said, keep in touch, let us know when you come back and we'll see if there's anything else on the schedule, you know. And so they were really accommodating.
That is accommodating.
Yeah, and it was just kind of lucky that things opened up, I think, when I came back. But I don't know. I've kind of not really got massive plans to audition for any big shows at the moment. I think just because it's nice having a home life and just it's nice being around for a bit. I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah. So your wife was on maternity leave when she was with a show. That's mm-hmm. a whole other topic in itself. I wouldn't know how that would work because the shows are so transient, aren't they? Most of them don't last for years and years. So how do you then, you know, if you suddenly find out you're pregnant and you've been on a show, a couple of months? Oh, that's an awkward conversation, isn't it?
They've been really good with her. I mean, because, yeah, it was literally, she'd been on it about a month. But I think pay-wise, you have to have been on it a certain amount of time to get, you know, full maternity cover and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But they're very good with, because it's a long running show, thankfully, you know, they've been really great with saying, go away, have the baby and come back when you feel you're ready. And, you know, we'll keep in contact with you. And so they've been great and they've been really,
really
supportive
good.
Over it, which is nice. Yeah.
So that leads me on to then, if you were out working on tour and your wife was on mat leave, your son must have been born while you were not on tour on the Boy in the Dress in London. So you were on constantly like, is he coming today? Is he going to come today? Like, was he born when you were away, like working away?
Yeah, he was actually due for our first preview of Boy in the Dress. And there was another guy in the company whose son was also due on the same day, which thankfully they timed out differently, because I think the producers were a bit like, we can't have two people off at the same time.
No, so that's like...
we're in a lot of trouble. Yeah. But I mean, the chances of that happening were slim. But it was, yeah, so it was in Stratford, and they give you these lovely cottages just opposite the theatre that we were all staying in. So my wife was staying in the cottages opposite, and yeah, Milo came a couple of days early. So thankfully, it was on the night actually where they were doing a big technical rehearsal, and they put the person that was understudying me on to do the rehearsal so that he knew what he was doing when the time came. So I had this evening where I got to actually watch the show, and I was feeling all emotional anyway, because I kind of knew I'd, you know, got this baby coming and it was a lovely show, and I was getting to see everyone like do it, which you never get to do when you're in it. And then came home, and yeah, and then kind of at about 1 o'clock in the morning, Amy was like, I think it's happening. And so, yeah, we tried to get in the car and get back to Milton Keynes, which is where...
From Stratford, you were like, right, we must go home now. That's where our arrangements are. We need to get back.
And, you know, when we phoned the hospital and that, they were like, well, obviously, you know, you could be in labour for some time, so just get to Milton Keynes. And literally, like, what was it, four or 6 hours later, we were in Warwick Hospital, because we'd had to just pull over the car, get in there quick, and he was born. And it was like madness, yeah.
Blimey, so he was a Stratford baby.
Yeah, he was, yeah. And then I was back on the show, like, I think the night after or the night after that, just feeling like I'd been slapped around the face. You know, that weird kind of just don't know what's going on, and suddenly there's an audience, and, you know, we're into previews, and I felt like a kind of, yeah, like I was just running on adrenaline.
I bet you were at that point. What other shows have you been in, Jamie? Like, were you in, I read that you were in the Rocky Horror Show. Like, I mean, I've got a bit of a story about this. It's really embarrassing. My school friend was in the West End after school, similar to you. I think she did go to drama school at some point. I don't know, but she got a job when I was in sixth form. She just went straight down and got some work, and she was in the Rocky Horror Show, and she said, if, could I go and see her in it? But it wasn't in London. I asked her the other day because I knew you were coming on. But she did it. I don't know where she did it now. She did tell me, but it wasn't in London. But I went to go and see her in it. It was somewhere random, like Chelmsford or something. And my boyfriend, now husband, came with me. We didn't have a clue what it was about. She said, oh, you come and see me this show. And we were like, yeah, okay, of course, because yeah, you're my mate. And that's been nice. Go and see a show. And when we got there, like, I was telling people that we were going, and they were like, oh, making a fuss. And we were just like, oh, yes, the theatre, nice. And then we got where everyone was in fancy dress. We did not have a clue. They all knew the words, singing along.
Yeah.
We just were like, and then comes my friend. I can't remember the name of the character, but the one that spends most of the time in a bra. That was like, oh there's my friend from school. he's my boyfriend. That's weird.
Oh, wow.
It was just like, so, I mean, you must have had a role, like a whale of a time doing that. It must be such fun to be in.
I loved it. Yeah. I was part of the fan club when I was a kid. Like, I was obsessed with it. I was absolutely obsessed as a teenager. And then, yeah, and then kind of got this job. It was like my first big tour. So I was 19 or 20. Flown out to Germany, and then suddenly was on this big European tour, and, you know, spending most kind of half the time on the tour bus and then half the time in hotels, and it was just bonkers. It was they cast it in London, New York and Hamburg, so it was an American, English, German cast, and it was just brilliant. I loved it, absolutely loved it. But yeah, it was crazy, and the audiences were bonkers, especially in Germany. They seemed to go for it even more.
I bet they would.
Yeah.
I've worked for a few German companies. They're it's like a veneer of something that you just don't have to scratch very far, and it's like, oh, crazy.
And I love their theatre. They have a real respect for theatre and for theatre performers. Like, they treat you really well. And yeah, I've worked a lot in Germany and toured a lot there, and always had just the best time.
So what about any gigs or shows that didn't go so well, Jamie? Like, we've heard some of the highlights. I know it's not great, but this isn't like an advert for your CV or anything. Just tell us tell us something that went particularly badly, if there is anything.
Oh, God. I've done a few wrong ones. Like, I've done, like, tours of old people's homes and stuff like that, where I'm just having to wear awful costumes. You know, I've been made to do things like play Baby Spice in a Spice Girls tribute, or Rolf Harris tribute, Jackie Wilson. Just I had to do a Dolly Parton number in like fake boobs and a blonde wig, and I was
like Monica from Friends.
Yeah. And I had to go and like sit on some old man's knee and stroke his face and stuff, and it was horrible. And so I've done a lot of odd kind of weird.
And when you say you were made to, is this your agent being like, Jamie, this would be really good for your career? Is that when you...
you kind of audition for these jobs, and this one I auditioned for, and it said, you know, venues in the Midlands and singing lots of different songs. And so I auditioned for it, got the job, and it turned out the venues were old people's homes, and it was the variety show. And so the director was kind of, you know, making us do all this stuff. Yeah, it was just like soul destroying. It's like, oh well, it's character building, need to do it.
Yeah, exactly. So do you continue to, I mean, you said you haven't got any plans now to really get more theatre work. Have you kind of, I don't know what you'd hang, you don't hang up your tap shoes. have you hung up your axe? What would you do? Hang up?
Yeah, I don't know really. Hang up my cravat.
Yeah, your cravat and your microphone. Yeah. I don't know, that's weird, isn't
my
it?
Skull in the cupboard.
Yeah.
I don't know really, because I mean, I've still got my agent and I'm still very much in touch with him, so been with them for about 15 years or something, and so I still get the odd I still get messages through for self tapes and stuff like that, for commercials and little bits in TV stuff, and he always keeps in touch about any theatre work going, so I just have to kind of see what happens. It's really difficult because every time I seem to plan something, something else happens and it changes, you know. But so I kind of think never say never. But I do feel at the moment, if I never did another theatre job again, then I've had the most incredible time. Like, I've loved it. And I would look back on it really fondly, and I don't think I'd have any regrets. Whereas if someone told me now I could never kind of do yoga, or I could never teach another yoga class, I'd be gutted, and I would feel... I couldn't imagine my life now without yoga. So it feels like that's a bit of a sign, and I'm just loving doing what I'm doing at the moment, and it feels like there's a future in it, and it feels like I'm really excited about every kind of step along the way and everything I'm learning and all that kind of stuff. So it feels like my life is definitely going more in that direction.
Oh, that's so nice to hear that you're so like that enthusiasm for it, despite everything that's happening at the moment. That's lovely.
Oh,
that it's not been extinguished, you know, it's still going. Because it is hard at the minute. It is hard, isn't it? Like you say, you mentioned earlier, you were filming in an empty room just to the screen in the corner. And it is challenging, isn't it? It's nice to get feedback from clients, but it's good that you've still got that passion for it.
Yeah. And it feels like it will be back, and it'll be lovely when it is back, you know, as in the room, kind of face to face. Yeah. So look forward to that.
Yeah. Whenever that is.
Oh. Yeah.
So what's been your proudest moment, Jamie?
Definitely becoming a dad. Like, it trumps everything. Yeah. Yeah. I've loved it.
We don't use the T word on this podcast.
Yeah. Forget that. He's gone.
Sorry, it's a bit topical, but I just couldn't avoid it. Couldn't let that go. There's probably not like the old school way of like, oh, like top trumps. That's probably
yeah.
Oh, it trumps that. We can't probably anymore. Can't use that anymore now.
No.
Changed. It's changed its meaning somewhat.
And doing a trump now, that you can't say that with.
Well, you probably still could.
Yeah.
That's probably still works out pretty fine. So you said about getting back to yoga and waiting for the theatre to reopen, maybe. If that, is there anything else that's next for you? Like, I've seen you're doing some aerial yoga training at the minute, is that right?
Oh, yeah, the trapeze yoga. It's brilliant. Yeah, I'm loving it. So I've just kind of sent all the stuff in. So I need to find out if I pass now. So hopefully we should find out in the next couple of days. But yeah, teaching that's kind of getting me through this lockdown as well, because it hasn't really felt like lockdown, because we've been carrying on the training, but just coming in on our own to use the trapezes in the studio and doing it all online and everything. And so it's felt like I've been more busy since lockdown than I was before it, because in between classes, I've been going in and hanging upside down for however long and, you know, trying to learn all those poses and everything. But it's really exciting and it's really fun. So I'm looking forward to teaching a lot of that.
Yeah, I think quite a few people have been doing some training during this summer, but if they haven't been able to be teaching as much, I haven't, but I know quite a few people. That was a good use of time.
Yeah. And it does work, the online teaching. It's been fun, and I felt like it still been able to keep involved with the teacher and keep engaged and learn everything I needed to know.
Good. So if you weren't a yoga teacher or actor or dancer or singer, Jamie, what would you be?
Oh God. Probably a teacher of some sort, or probably working with kids. Like, I've worked on and off in between jobs, working with kids with special needs and things like that. And I used to really enjoy that. I used to get, you know, kind of, it was quite rewarding. So it'd probably be something along those lines.
Good. That sounds good. Well, it's now time for quick fire questions. And you'll be glad to know I have adapted these slightly for you being a male, but oh, yeah, only very slightly. We only had to do one tweak. All right. So you'll see when it is. It's really obvious.
Yeah.
All right. So just say what comes into your mind. No wrong answer. You just say what you feel. So late to bed or early to rise?
Late to bed.
Oddest thing in your man bag? See.
Oh, oddest thing in my man bag. Oh my God, probably just spare pants.
That is odd.
Well, very sweaty teaching.
Who do you look up to?
Who do I look up to? I look up to my dad, actually. Yeah.
Oh, what's your favourite film?
My favourite film of all time is With Nail and I.
I'm just laughing because I watched that with my husband. I'm aside now briefly on the quickfire questions. I watched that with people had said it to us. It was a classic. It's a classic. And yeah, we watched that not that long ago, like a few months ago. It was during lockdown and we didn't really get it. No, so I think it's dated a lot.
Yeah. Oh, another one though. I've got to mention as well, Life is Beautiful or La Vita Bella. That's like, yeah, I kind of go back and forth.
Okay.
Which one's my actual favourite?
On a scale of 1 to 10, how cool are you, Jamie?
Oh, I'd say probably about a 3.
Mountainside or lakeside?
Lakeside.
Tom Hanks or Leonardo DiCaprio?
Leonardo DiCaprio.
What's your star sign?
Taurus.
Who would you swap lives with just for a day?
Oh, oh God, the Queen. I'd just like to see how it all worked.
That's a good one. Countryside or city?
Countryside.
If you owned a yacht, what would you call it?
Well, I used to own a boat, and that was called Man.
So no one said that yet. Oh, I have already owned a boat, and its name was... What was the name? Sorry.
It was a narrow boat called Mallard. Like a canal. I've done that for 4 years, so I should really pay homage to that.
What was its name?
Mallard. Yeah, I didn't name it, but you know, you can't rename boats once you bought them. That's a thing, apparently.
Not like pets. So, what is at the top of your bucket list?
Travel. I want to drag the family traveling with me. Yeah.
Would it be a drag? As
no,
in, would you
all.
Have to drag
no.
them? Not that, no. Oh, would it be a drag for you having them along?
No, I think I'd just like to get a job that kind of, or something linked to yoga that meant that I had to go and teach in another country and I could just bring the family along. Like, that'd be like the dream, you know.
Interesting. What's your, I'm not sure whether this, what have you, I can't speak now. Describe your baddest and brightest leggings. I mean, do you wear leggings to teaching?
No, I don't. No, I've had to wear leggings a lot on stage, but I've not brought them into the yoga studio yet.
Okay. Favorite place in the whole wide world?
Do you know what? There's this spa in Munich called Therme Erding, which I've been to loads of times whenever I was touring there. And I'm still a little bit obsessed with it. And it's just this lovely, massive spa.
Wow. So that brings us... Oh, your favourite yoga pose?
Oh, do you know what? I really like baby grasshopper pose. I think because It looks really impressive, but you can get people into it. And it's so lovely when you see people's faces. When you say, oh, and we're going to be working towards this, and they look at you as if to say, not in a million years. And then 10 minutes later, they're doing it. It's the most exciting thing in the world.
I know, Jamie, that's so funny you say that. I've been, that's one of the few arm balances I can actually manage.
It's so like Instagrammable, isn't it? You want to just get a camera straight away.
Yeah, and I've been teaching that this month to my students, and the same, like, they're looking at me, I'll do it, and they're like, no, that's not going to happen. Yeah. And then I talk them through, and they're like, on their faces, yeah. The shock
when you
on
see
their
the
faces.
Lift off the ground, and you see that bit of air under the hip, you're like, yes.
Brilliant. Oh, so thank you. Oh, I nearly forgot. What is your favorite music for Savasana? Or Savasana sounds? Have you got any tracks or Shavasana, any tracks that you recommend?
Do you know what? I've got two. There's one for like really kind of relaxed, kind of stretch based classes called Spiegel im Spiegel by Arvo Part, which I really like. Which incidentally is also the music that we're using to try and get Milo, my son, off to sleep at the moment because he's teething and it seems to work a treat. So it's like double whammy.
Dual purpose.
Yeah. But it's about 8 minutes long. So you have to kind of like, you know, it kind of kicks off when they're in their last supine twists and that before a Shavasana. But if it's a more energized class, if it's a hot class, I really like, there's a song called No One Knows Me Like the Piano by a guy called Sampha, Sampha, which I really like playing, kind of get people winding down.
Oh, that's lovely. I'll put those on the episode notes so that people can have a listen. I've learnt so many nice tracks while I've been doing these interviews. So I'm looking forward to listen to those. Thank you, Jamie. Well, in general, thank you so much for chatting to me. It's been really great to get to know you a bit better. So listeners, you can contact Jamie through his Insta. It's Jamie Tyler Yoga. Please tell him what you thought of the podcast. And if you've got any questions for him, I'm sure he'll be happy to answer them for you.
Excellent. Thank you.
You've been listening to That Yoga Woman's podcast with me, Jules Buchanan. If you like the show, please tell your friends about it, share it on social media, rate it, write a nice review, and subscribe to That Yoga Woman's podcast. Links and information can be found on the episode page in the podcast section of my website, www.thatyogawoman.com/podcast. If you'd like to show some support for the podcast, you can do that through PayPal. The donation link is www.paypal.me/thatyogawoman. The last thing I'll mention is my line of organic cotton yoga-inspired tops. I designed a small range of vest tees and sweatshirts that are perfect to teach or do yoga in. Have a look online, check out my shop on my website, www.thatyogawoman.com/shop. Have a look around my store and make an order. See you soon.